From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is planning a visit soon to the storm-ravaged Florida panhandle, but first, a political rally tonight in Ohio. He's also facing questions today about what his administration will do about the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a critic of the Saudi regime, a regime that strongly supports President Trump.
The Washington Post reports today that Turkish government officials have told U.S. counterparts that they have not just video, but audio evidence that Khashoggi was tortured and killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Yesterday, the president said he was concerned that criticism of the Saudis would end business deals. Let's convene our Friday roundtable. Juana Summers is Associated Press national political reporter. She joins us this week. Hi, Juana.
Hi there.
And we also have Paul Kane, Washington Post congressional reporter. Paul, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Paul, we're going to start with you because your paper has been reporting deeply on your colleague, Jamal Khashoggi, a columnist for the paper. Let's listen to what the president said yesterday in the office, in the Oval Office, when asked about the Saudis.
They're spending $110 billion purchasing military equipment and other things. If we don't sell it to them, they'll say, well, thank you very much. We'll buy it from Russia. Or thank you very much. We'll buy it from China.
That was kind of a wince moment, Paul, for some people, putting business deals ahead of human rights. And your paper is also reporting about Trump's personal deals with the Saudis. For instance, they're booking in his hotels. Your sense of how that moment went over?
I think it went over like a lead balloon up on Capitol Hill. They had a bipartisan just dispute with Trump how he handled it. They were only a few votes short of blocking the Saudi sales earlier this year. So I think you could really have a problem up there if he continues to use this rhetoric.
How would that work? How can Congress do that?
They have started this Magnitsky Act investigation essentially, and which basically it's a really broad sweeping law that allows people that could compel the State Department and the administration to try and decide whether or not they did sort of commit this assassination. And if they find that that is the case, there's a lot of sweeping power that they could force a lot of sanctions on Saudi Arabia.
Let's hear from Republican Bob Corker of Tennessee, who basically accused Saudi Arabia of murder.
The intel points directly at them and them thinking about this in advance. I mean, I think they did it, and unfortunately I think that he's deceased.
So the news is looking grim, but an interesting factor of this is that both parties, lawmakers from both side parties, are really putting pressure on the president.
Absolutely. You've got Chris Murphy, a liberal from Connecticut, Bob Corker, Rand Paul. Rand Paul and Chris Murphy have basically been the two biggest proponents of trying to rein in sales to the Saudis. And they're only a few votes away. And if leadership sort of breaks, then you could really see a big sweeping vote against Saudi Arabia.
Well, Juana Summers from the Associated Press, as all this was swirling, the questions about, when are we going to put pressure on the Saudis with Turkey saying that this happened in the consulate, that he was murdered. And as, speaking of swirling, Hurricane Michael was swirling towards the Carolinas, leaving devastation in its path in Florida. The president had lunch with Kanye West. Now, normally this would seem like a silly thing, but it was in the middle of this huge news cycle. I want to see how this fits in, get your opinion on that. He was wearing his Make America Great Again red hat, and he went on a several minute long defense of his friendship with President Trump, dropping the F-bomb in the Oval Office on one occasion. Let's listen to a little.
They tried to scare me to not wear this hat, my own friends, but this hat, it gives me power in a way. My dad and my mom separated, so I didn't have a lot of male energy in my home. And also, I'm married to a family that, not a lot of male energy going on.
Juana Summers, it went on for quite a long time. At one point, he embraced the president, leapt across the desk to embrace him. I thought, oh my God, the Secret Service must have had a heart attack at that moment. But what do you make? Because the split screen showed the devastation of a hurricane.
Yeah, you know, the president at one point during Kanye West's extended monologue, he stopped for a second. He said, you know, that was quite something. And I'd have to say I agree. This was a really fascinating split screen. But I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is while you have these two kind of men who were born of reality TV and the starlight in this conversation, in the surreal kind of moment, they were also talking about policy. We heard them in this conversation talking about manufacturing, gangs, prison reform. You heard Kanye West actually contradict the president's statements from earlier this month about the controversial stop and frisk policy and whether or not that would actually be useful in the city of Chicago, which, as we all know, has struggled with crime. I do think, though, that we're still seeing what the death toll will be of the hurricane. We've obviously seen a number of been reported dead now, some really striking images of devastation. We're also 25 days out from the midterm elections. The idea that the president's sitting down with someone like Kanye West, I think, is very, very interesting strategically.
Well, talk just briefly about that, because we heard many African-American voices going on the cable shows decrying it because, well, and Don Lemon from CNN said it was a minstrel show. They feel that it's a black man being used by President Trump. There are others who have spoken up and said, hey, here's a guy. He has the right to, as African-Americans, we have the right to make our own decisions about who we are for or against. What's your sense of how that might have resonated? Because in the past, the President Trump has held up Kanye West as an example of how he appeals to the African-American community.
He has, and I think that we have to look at that against the backdrop of some of the things the president has said about his support among African Americans. He has claimed falsely on a number of occasions that he's won more black voters than Republican presidents and candidates in the past, and that's just simply not the case. He's also made claims, as my colleague Aaron Wack reported this week, about having made the black unemployment rate at its lowest ever, and while the unemployment rate among African Americans has dropped, whether or not that is all attributable to the Trump presidency is something that's in question,
well,
and I think most economists would disagree with.
Dropped even further during the Obama administration.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think that the idea that because the president is sitting down with Kanye West that he would suddenly gain more African-American supporters or win more African-American voters to other Republican candidates, I just think that there isn't a lot of facts to back up that statement.
Yeah, I want to bring in what's going on with the stock market this week because, you know, that could be an issue in the midterms as well, especially in terms of what it says about the broader economy. Yesterday on Fox and Friends, President Trump once again criticized the Federal Reserve for raising interest rates three times so far this year, and that's one of the reasons why the stock market was going down this week.
You know, the Federal Reserve is getting a little bit too cute, that's all. That's ridiculous what they're doing.
Paul, thoughts how this will affect the midterm?
The reality is the economy has just not played a big role in this election. It is doing well. But whether it's better than improving at a better rate than under Obama, that's all up in the air. But the reality is the economy is doing well, but it still hasn't been a big issue for Republicans on a positive level. So I don't know what the stock market, if it continues to crash, whether that would then create another bad and sentiment. It's really hard to know because it's just been a weird election in which the cultural issues keep dominating and overcoming anything to do with the economy.
Hey, you know, I said this last Friday and I say it again. Just a few weeks ago, an anonymous member claiming to be – well, the Times also claimed it was a member of the Trump administration wrote that anonymous letter in the New York Times saying that they were – you know, they were running the show and that President Trump could not. And that's gone, you know, from our conversation. But entering into the conversation this week is civility. After the brutal, bruising Kavanaugh battle, Republicans leapt on Hillary Clinton for saying this on CNN.
If we are fortunate enough to win back the House and or the Senate, that's when civility can start again. But until then, the only thing that the Republicans seem to recognize and respect is strength.
And then you had former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder kind of making a play on Michelle Obama's 2016 mantra.
But Michelle says that, you know, when they go low, we go high. No. When they go low, we kick them.
Okay, so a Holder later clarified. He said, no, we just have to be strong. That's what I meant. We don't physically hurt somebody. But Trump warned Holder, better be careful for what he wishes for. Well, the right is seizing on this, Juana. They're just seizing on this as an example of how it's the Democrats that are being uncivil in what some saw as, you know, Brett Kavanaugh actually being the attack dog during the confirmation hearings.
That's absolutely right. We've heard a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill make this argument, right, particularly about the protests and uproar around Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings. They've talked about being shouted out of restaurants, having people show up at their doors. One Republican member of Congress talking about abusive and harassing text messages that his spouse got. So Republicans have certainly tried to do this. It reminds me, though, back of 2010, 2011, when Democrats used some similar language about civility when it came to the Tea Party, when it was on the rise ahead of the 2010, the 2010 elections, really.
Yeah. And each side, there's a lot of finger pointing on each side. Juana Summers, Associated Press, national political reporter. Paul Kane, Washington Post congressional reporter. We have the weekend coming. You know, maybe there'll be a break in the news. Not happening. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
The research is clear. Not getting enough sleep is dangerous, even deadly. Drowsy driving causes fatal car accidents. Inadequate sleep contributes to obesity and diabetes. Or, as a writer in The Guardian put it after reading Matthew Walker's terrific book, Why We Sleep, not sleeping has been making me stupider, fatter, unhappier, poorer, sicker, worse at sex, as well as more likely to get cancer, Alzheimer's, and die in a car crash. And yet many of us just can't sleep, even knowing that. And students top the list. There's homework, sports, clubs, bravado. Many get just a few hours a night. Well, now some schools are taking action. Dr. Charles Seisler is chief of the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. They have a Sleep Matters initiative. He also teaches a sleep class at Harvard University. And because of the success of that class, Harvard now has a mandatory online sleep class for incoming freshmen, and it's going to be expanded to upperclassmen as well. Dr. Seisler is with us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You were just telling us that Harvard was so pleased with what happened when the freshman students took this online course before coming in. Why? What were they pleased about? What happened that they want to now extend this online course to all the students?
Well, they were pleased by, first of all, the response. More than 90% of the students took the course, and students were actually lining up to fill out the questionnaire about their positive responses to the pre-matriculation program.
Well, what are you fighting against? I mean, anyone who's been in school knows that there is almost a, you know, leave to the last minute part of this where kids are working overnight. But we understand that in some schools now, including Harvard, some of their group study groups meet at 10 or midnight.
Or 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And there's, of course, one of the most popular courses, a computer science course that has actually hackathons where the students are scheduled to work all night as part of the course. And then they have their other responsibilities. I mean, the football team has them getting up at 4:30 in the morning to be lifting weights just after 5. And then they may have another class that has evening classes. So the students are being pulled in many different directions. Many times problem sets are due, let's say, at 8 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning. And that just is a setup for the students staying up all night.
Well, I want to extend this to all young people because not everyone goes to college. And not everyone is staying up late in high school because they're finishing their science project. They have phones and they have their social media. That's keeping kids up.
Absolutely. In fact, just the light, the predominant wavelength that is driving that light that we're seeing on the screen is in the blue part of the spectrum, which tells the brain that it's daytime. It's like the blue sky. And that resets our circadian rhythms, and it makes it actually more difficult for us to fall asleep. And it does so in kind of an insidious manner because the internal clock sends the strongest drive for waking just before what would be dusk. So during evolution, we couldn't see during the nighttime, and the brain sent a powerful waking signal so we would get our act together and be in a safe place when it got dark and we couldn't see anything. Well, that worked great at that time, but now we have, through artificial light exposure, shifted our circadian rhythms by 4 or 5 time zones westward just by the light that we get exposed to between dusk outside and when we decide to switch off the lights.
Well, there's that. We talked about some of the health issues that arise just from not sleeping enough. We've read Matthew Walker's terrific book, Why We Sleep, which is now out in paperback. We've seen the National Geographic Channel, Sleepless in America. You're featured in there. So, I mean, not sleeping really can be fatal?
Well, I mean, you talked about the motor vehicle crashes. Nearly 7,000 people a year die in sleep-related crashes on our nation's highways. It's responsible for 1 out of 5 car crash injuries and deaths.
Well, and in Matthew Walker's book, you know, he lists the problems that can be caused, including the car crashes, but he also does a fun thing where he does a fake ad for a new miracle drug that will make you live longer, enhance your memory, make you more attractive because it keeps you slim, protects you from cancer and dementia. It wards off colds and flu. It lowers your risk of heart attacks and stroke, not to mention diabetes. Are you interested? Well, of course, it's sleep.
Absolutely.
Sleep keeps you thin? Sleep keeps you,
it
keeps
does.
Colds
it reduces
away?
Your appetite. I mean, if you're not getting enough sleep, for example, when you get the flu shot, you only have half the antibody response. If you're sleeping, let's say, less than 5 hours a night, you have a 300% increased risk over a 5-year period of calcification of the coronary arteries, which leads to heart attacks and other adverse outcomes.
As I said, I want to go lay down right now and just prepare for the Grim Reaper. But how do you convey this to students? And it's part of the culture to see, you know, who can stay up the latest.
Well, part of the program, we call it Sleep 101. It's a very interactive program in which, for example, there's a dorm room, and the students can click on a coffee cup in the dorm room and find out that caffeine has a 6 to 9 hour half-life. And many people are not aware of that, that they may take a cup of coffee after dinner and not realize that 6 hours later they still have half of that caffeine on board. Mm. So they get information like they click on their sneakers and they find out that if they tank up on sleep, they can improve their reaction time. If they're on a sports team, they'll shorten the turn time in swimming. They can get more basketball free throws in. And one of the things that students don't realize is that it's not just the amount of sleep, but a consistency in the timing of sleep.
Yeah.
So students have irregular schedules. They don't do as well academically. And one of the reasons we think that underlies that is that if you have an irregular schedule, usually the internal clock shifts you later. So when we've studied Harvard students, we found that those who had irregular schedules, even if they got the same duration of sleep at inconsistent times, they were shifted to California time, even though they were studying here in Boston. Mm. And that meant that if they have a 8 or 9 a.m. class, that would be happening at 5 or 6 a.m. biological time on their internal clock. So it's no wonder that they don't do as well in those classes, because when they take the test or when they're trying to pay attention,
wow,
it's the middle of the night.
Wow. So how do you change school life so that kids can sleep more? I mean, maybe an obvious thing is not have a study group at 1 a.m.
Right. So when I have been teaching a freshman seminar, every year at the end of the term, the 15 students in the seminar have to make a TED-like talk in which they make a case for what they think could improve sleep health, for example, that there should be an 11-hour interval, one student argued, between the end of the last scheduled activity, school-sanctioned activity, and the first scheduled activity in the morning. Another student suggested that assignments be due 10 o'clock in the evening rather than at 9 o'clock in the morning.
So look, you're working, we're talking to you most specifically about students, but you've got this Sleep Matters initiative from Brigham and Women's Hospital. And, you know, there are specific groups of people who need help, shift workers. Firefighters who took this program were 24% less likely to report an injury, used half as many disability days. I mean, you really can trace how, you know, life is just better from injuries to work output because of sleep. And we'll post some of this at hereandnow.org.
The thing I was excited about that is that a lot of people had given up on firefighters and said, well, they work 24 to 48-hour shifts. There's nothing you can do to help their sleep. And we implemented a simple program of sleep health education and wellness for the firefighters. It took about an hour.
Give me one detail.
So we did sleep disorder screening, for example. For 10 minutes, they filled out a few validated questionnaires, and we identified if they're at high risk for sleep apnea or chronic insomnia or other disorders, and we referred them to treatment. Turns out that 1 out of 3 men and 1 out of 6 women have sleep apnea. And that means that even if they set aside the time for sleep, if you can't breathe and sleep at the same time, you're not going to get the rest that you need. And when we first came to present to them, they made fun of the whole thing. They brought pillows to the sessions, were kidding everybody, saying, oh, I got to have my sleep session and so on. But then when we started showing them the information, we feel that this is it's a right for people to have this information, to understand that untreated sleep apnea, for example, after 18 years, only 58% of them are still alive, as opposed to 94% of them without sleep apnea, mm-hmm. because it increases the risk of cardiovascular death by 420%. Mm-hmm. And we've had amazing feedback from people who say, oh my God, this changed my whole life. My depression was resolved. I didn't need to stay on medications anymore. My marriage came back together. It can really have a major impact. And all we provide people is information and screening.
But what if you just, you know, you want to sleep more and you just, you put your head down and you can't?
So if for people with chronic insomnia, let's say, one thing that they can do, and which is quite effective, is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It can be done online. One program is called Sleepio, another is called Shut Eye. These are interactive programs, again, that help identify sleep stealers in the environment. And that's part of our education program, too. You know, I love dogs, for example. But we have two, but they don't belong in the bed because they're quite disruptive to sleep. And so there are a lot of tips that are provided.
Try a cat.
Right. Alcohol interferes with sleep. Yeah. So every shot, it takes 2 hours to metabolize, or every glass of wine. And then there are some new technologies. There's a new product called an EB, which is, it's kind of like a little headband, which actually does brain cooling to help people with chronic insomnia get to sleep faster. And that's just been approved by the FDA.
I'm writing that Sleepio, Shut Eye with the letter I, and EB. Again, well, not that I would need this.
Of course not.
Desperately. Just terrific. Dr. Charles Seisler, who teaches a sleep class at Harvard University, which is also offering online courses to all the students now. He's also behind the Sleep Matters Initiative at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he's chief of the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders. Thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll have a lot of links to everything we talked about at hereandnow.org. And by the way, Dr. Seisler also told us that if you're taking over-the-counter melatonin, he believes it doesn't work to help you sleep. But there are some things in the pipeline that will. We'll have him back to talk about that. You know, just for the students.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The coastal resort town of Mexico Beach, Florida, suffered some of the worst damage from Hurricane Michael. 80 miles to the west, Alligator Point, Florida, hasn't fared much better. Sean Kearns returned there last night after evacuating to Jacksonville, and we've got him on the line now. Sean, thank you for speaking with us under these circumstances. How are you holding up?
We're doing well. Yeah, we're a good community out here. We know that hurricanes can come. We live on the Gulf of Mexico, and we prepare for them. We evacuate, we come back, we clean up, and we go on.
I've seen pictures of your community, though. It does not look good. The roads are buckling, houses wiped off their foundations. Is your home okay?
Yeah, we have our home is 15 feet in the air on about 16 concrete pilings driven way into the ground. So we had no structural damage whatsoever. The water came up about 6 feet. We have underneath the house storage that smells like fish, and we're trying to clean that out now. But a lot of mud, you know, it's 6 feet of water. So, and it's gone away, but you can imagine what it looks like.
Yeah. And your neighbors?
Some of our neighbors fared well. Some of them, you know, like you say, the houses fell off their foundations. Some left theirs. There's boat and boat motors in the roads.
And now you're living there again. Do you have the basics, like running water?
Yeah, the water's back onto the houses, but they're not onto the fire hydrants because that main is broken in a few places in the roads. But we have running water. We have a generator. We have a little window air conditioner unit. So we just locked ourselves in one of the small rooms and turn on the air conditioner and keep our phones charged. We can communicate with family, and we've got the refrigerator running.
So you're on a generator. The power is out, though.
Yeah, there won't be power out here for a while.
Yeah. Now, you're a firefighter on the volunteer department there in Alligator Point. Are you in first responder mode at all at this point, going around from house to house, making sure that everyone's okay? Or are people able to get the help that they need?
Yeah, we did. We split up and walked the houses yesterday. We took the chainsaws out and cleared the trees out of the road. We don't have any radio communication with Franklin County Dispatch, so if someone calls 911, we're not going to get a typical page or radio call. So we're working off one old 800 megahertz walkie-talkie that will that they can call us on, and I have that, and then I would text or start making phone calls to other volunteers.
Some people will ask themselves long-term, big-picture questions about whether or not they want to stay in a place like where you live after a huge hurricane like this. But I also imagine that to a certain extent, you just have to go minute to minute, hour by hour as this cleanup continues. What's next for you today? When we get off the phone and I say goodbye to you, what are you going to go do?
Well, I got the power washer out. We got running water and a generator, so I'm going to start cleaning the mud up under the house. And then I've still got my business in Tallahassee that I've got to worry about. We don't have power there. That might be a while, too. So got employees that need to be taken care of, and we just go about our, just start putting things together.
Yeah. In a way, I guess you might feel lucky.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a house. Some of our neighbors don't.
Yeah. Well, look, I hope you know the rest of the country is watching, pulling for you and your neighbors. Best of luck to you in the next few days and months.
Thank you.
Sean Kearns, one of the lucky ones in Alligator Point, Florida.
Whatever happened to Idlib? This province is the only large area still held by anti-Assad regime forces in Syria. Remember, a few weeks ago, we reported that the Syrian army, backed by Russian and Iranian allies, was poised to mount an offensive to take Idlib back, which is expected to be a bloodbath. But Russia and Turkey struck a fragile deal to wait, to establish a demilitarized zone around Idlib and give rebel and radical groups deadlines to leave. So what happened? BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen is in London, but just back from a reporting trip in Idlib on the regime side, front line, soldiers in foxholes. Pretty remarkable. Jeremy, some of those deadlines for leaving are right about now. So what did you see? Are the rebels militants leaving?
Well, so far, they seem to be respecting the whole thing. It's the 12th now, and the final deadline is on the 15th. So we've got a couple of days. By the 15th, they're meant to have moved both their men and their heavy weapons out of this new DMZ that they've been put together by the Turks and the Russians. So, you know, we'll see. But up to now, according to the Turks, who also, of course, have a stake in saying it's going well, up to now, they appear to be moving.
And then what happens then? If let's say it's a Syrian group that rose up, you know, against the Assad regime during the Arab Spring before radical groups came in from elsewhere and, you know, kind of fill a vacuum there. Mm. If it's these Syrians, what happens when they start leaving that area? Aren't they going to be targeted?
The estimate that's being used by the UN is that 90,000 men who carry guns are in there. And of that, 15 to 20,000 are what you might call diehard jihadis. I think that what this DMZ does, it basically postpones dealing with the issue.
Well, meantime, here you are on the front lines. What did you see there, including troops that apparently didn't want to be seen?
The troops that didn't want to be seen were Russians. Some were okay with talking, but they weren't at all good about being filmed or recorded in any way. The Russians are very noticeable around there. In terms of the physical state of the area, you drive along and there is one wrecked village after another wrecked village, and mostly those places are ghost towns.
Yeah, let's listen to a little of the sound that you gathered, though, because in these destroyed towns around the region, you found Abu Muhammad, who'd been able to reopen his barbershop, astonishingly. Let's listen.
We always hope for a peaceful solution, not bloodshed and destruction. We hope they reach a deal, please all parts. War leaves a lot of victims and dead.
So you stumbled across him, but from your reporting, it seemed like you wandered around wondering, where did these people go? They'd either become refugees in these mostly empty towns or had been killed.
Well, I wondered every time I saw yet another empty town. I thought, well, what's happened to these guys? And I had to conclude that probably a lot of them are over the border in Turkey. The Turkish border isn't very far from Idlib at all. And I think some will be dead, and others will be inside Idlib city itself. Because, you see, the way Idlib was used by the regime in the last couple of years is that as they did a shelled or did a deal with rebels in different enclaves to give up, they offered them a way out where they would be bussed up to Idlib. And that's where they went. And that's why there are so many guys up there.
Yeah.
And in some cases, their families as well. I think, though, that if you drive around that area as we did and we talked to a lot of people, you do get an idea about the way that the war's torn the heart out of the country. Yeah. It has done so much, not just physical, but in terms of what it does to people's minds, and also the way that it's just destroyed the fabric of everything. If you're in the center of Damascus, it looks like nothing ever happened. Mm. But when you go out of Damascus and you go up to places like the area around Idlib, then you can really see what the war has done in terms of absolute devastation and disaster.
Well, so what do you think happens now? Because it's not just the Syrian diehard rebels who are being funneled into this demilitarized zone, and the Islamist militias along with them that have, taken advantage of the situation there. You have the Kurds who've been fighting the Assad regime as well. These are U.S.-backed Kurds. And now we have Turkey's President Erdogan threatening to expand his country's military efforts in parts of northern Syria to take on these U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters. Look, people anticipate that the Syrian forces backed by Russia and Iran will take back Idlib. There will be the end of the sort of the civil war. But you've got, U.S. interests, Iranian interests, Russian interests, Turkish interests. What do you anticipate happens now?
Essentially, the dangers of all of that is that some of these guys can start bumping into each other in a bad way. So Syria is not guaranteed peace once, if you like, the civil war part of the war ends.
The BBC Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen from London, after his trip to Idlib in Syria. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now to Pakistan, where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has taken the concept of crowdfunding to another level. He wants to build a dam, and he's trying to raise $14 billion to do it. NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid reports from Karachi.
Saqib Nisar, the Chief Justice, can be considered an activist judge. He's made surprise visits to hospitals to check up on their cleanliness. He's questioned police who bungled a rape investigation. And in July, after a flurry of reports warning Pakistan would be water scarce, he summoned bureaucrats who manage the country's water.
They informed him that the water shortages are the result of insufficient storages in Pakistan.
That's Khurram Hussain. He's the business editor at Dawn, a local newspaper. He says officials told the Chief Justice that Pakistan's water shortage problems would be resolved if a dam on the Indus River was finally finished.
And it seems the Chief Justice took it to heart and decided that he himself is going to help raise these funds. And he announced the creation of what he called a dam fund, in which he called upon ordinary citizens to contribute money voluntarily.
From Karachi's noisy slums to leafy suburbs, banners hang on bank buildings urging people to give money. There's public service announcements where kids drink water and wave Pakistani flags and urge you to text a donation. And the campaigns triggered a donation frenzy. Pakistan's army gave about $8 million. Celebrities routinely announce their donations. A retired brigadier, Haris Nawaz, pledged $4,000. He says they need the dams because
Pakistan will have a lot of scarcity of water and our national survival will be difficult.
So far, the Chief Justice has raised over $33 million. At this rate, it'll still take over 100 years to reach the goal. But recently, the Prime Minister said he'd lead the project, so investors are more likely to pitch in. The dam supporters say it will help Pakistan grow more crops and prevent flooding. The power it will generate will ease Pakistan's chronic energy problems. But there have been complaints. Some companies with cases before the court are making public donations. Hussain, the business editor.
There's definitely a sense growing that you can curry favour by making these donations.
The Chief Justice himself has creatively fundraised.
He has begun demanding contributions into the fund as part of the legal penalties that he's imposing on people.
If this sounds like unbound judicial activism, reporters can't quiz the Chief Justice because he won't speak to the media, and he's warned he'll consider filing treason charges against critics of the project. But this dam is controversial. Multiple water resource experts tell us Pakistan's most urgent problem isn't water shortages, it's fixing the allocation system. And there's resistance. We travel downstream from the dam to a seaside fishing community. Muhammad Ali Shah is an activist. He talks about the water cycle.
Water cycle.
And he says previous dams built on the Indus River dried up the water that used to flow here. He points to the sandy, garbage-strewn fields around us. They used to be pasture. Shah says the Chief Justice's dam will cause further damage. He takes us on a boat to show us mangrove forests, shrubby islands that need both fresh and seawater to survive. They're nurseries for fish and sustain stock for the fishermen here. We stop nearby.
Most of the mangroves forests were decimated when the other dams were built.
Shah says another dam will destroy the mangroves and the communities that rely on them. He says when this dam was first planned, they hoped to challenge it in the courts.
Chief Justice Saqib Nisar ke amal ke baad.
We had pinned our hopes on the Supreme Court. But after the Chief Justice actions, there's no possibility we will get justice.
Shah says they'll still fight, but the very institution they hope would hear their grievances appears to now be leading the charge against them. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Karachi.
A&E debuts a new documentary on Monday. It's called Chris Rock's Bring the Pain. Before his rise as a stand-up star, Rock was seen as a failing protege of Eddie Murphy, who'd been fired from Saturday Night Live. But a 1996 HBO special resurrected Rock's career. The new documentary chronicles that moment and its impact on American culture. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
You were actually a critic in 1996 as well. What did you think of Bring the Pain when it came out?
I'm feeling old now for some reason, but yeah, I actually was. I remember actually getting a VHS screener to the tape of Bring the Pain and seeing it before it actually aired, and I was blown away by it because I always had this sense that Chris Rock was this guy, seemed like he might be funny, he could be cool, but you know, you see him on Saturday Night Live, he's hardly ever in any sketches, and when he is in a sketch, he's not that funny. And you know, there was this sense of, you know, is this guy really as good as you might think he would be, given that Eddie Murphy had taken him under his wing? And this special was the beginning of the Chris Rock that we all know.
Okay, so let's go to the Wayback Machine. 1996, this is Chris Rock in Bring the Pain talking about the O.J. Simpson trial.
O.J. was big. That's right. Black people too happy, white people too mad. I ain't seen white people that mad since they canceled MASH. Black people way too happy. Like, hey, we won! We won! Yeah, we won! Every day I look in the mailbox for my OJ prize, nothing.
So, Eric, people in the documentary talk about how Chris Rock's jokes toe this line that a lot of people would be afraid to cross. Isn't that kind of exactly what comedy is supposed to be, to go as close as you possibly can?
Yeah, but the way he did it was pretty intense. And he had a section of that OJ bit where he talked about how, you know, Nicole Brown Simpson had a car that OJ bought for her that she let Ron Goldman drive, according to his joke. You know, he kind of humorously details this information, and then he says, now, I'm not saying he should have killed her, but I understand. And so in that moment, you're laughing, but you're also like, I'm laughing at the fact that he's, you know, saying that there might be a reason to explain why this guy might have killed her. And now, of course, we understand that when it comes to sort of abusive relationships and things like that, it's not about anything that you can reason away. But at the time, there were some people who thought that way about how abusive relationships worked. And he put his finger right on it, saying, OJ was wrong, but here's a way of looking at this that you might not have thought about. And there weren't many comics at that time that were doing that.
And I think we have some more tape here of Chris Rock talking about his OJ jokes.
It's too easy to go, he's innocent, which is like, I've saw those routines. And it's too easy to go, he's a monster. The real funny is in that middle.
Otherwise, it's just preaching.
Hmm. Interesting point there. Back to Bring the Pain, there is this famous bit that is, frankly, hard to talk about on the radio. Let's just say it.
Let's get into it. So he had this bit where he talked about the difference between N-words, and he used the actual word, and black people. And he called it like a civil war going on in the black community. Hmm. And then he went on to tell all of these jokes about what N-words do. So he would say N-words always want credit for something that they're supposed to be doing. An N-word would say, you know, I take care of my kids. Well, you're supposed to take care of your kids. Now, the context of this is that this is the mid-1990s when gangster rap is not only taking over black music, it's taking over pop culture. And this idea of the sort of rebellious, violent young black man was really taking prominence in pop culture. But there's a bunch of black folks sort of looking at that and saying, well, you know, that doesn't really represent my values. That's not really what I stand for. And there's this friction in the community.
And it was so tense at one point that he almost got into a fight with the rapper Tupac.
In the documentary, they talk about how one time he ran into Tupac, I think in a club, and Tupac wanted to challenge him to a fight because basically that N-word versus black people, well, the N-word is embodied by gangster rappers like Tupac. Mm-hmm. And then also he did it in Oakland. Well, there were a lot of black folks in Oakland who felt like, well, he's talking about me. And so they got mad and they walked out. So this was not a routine that was universally accepted. But it articulated something that was happening in black culture that people hadn't quite figured out how to talk about. I mean, I remember when I saw it, I was like, wow. I mean, it's the kind of thing that a lot of people have been thinking, but how do you say it in a way that's funny but also makes the point? And he found a way.
Now, W. Kamau Bell is the director of this documentary. He's a comedian in his own right. What do you think motivated him to take this story on?
Well, Kamau's connection to Chris Rock goes back a ways. I think Kamau's first TV show, Chris Rock was the executive producer, and I think he helped him actually get that show on FX. And so Kamau, who has now, he has a CNN show now, United Shades of America, that's won an Emmy Award. And so it makes sense that somebody like that who knows race, who knows stand-up comedy, who knows a little bit about how to put a great documentary together would do this piece about someone who had been his TV godfather back in the day and talk about what was a pivotal moment for black comics and for black people in the 1990s and a pivotal moment for Chris Rock, certainly.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, hey, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And Chris Rock's Bring the Pain airs Monday on A&E. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.